This is KUNC's Colorado Edition. I'm Erin O'Toole.
And I'm Ashley Jeffcoat. We've got a lot to get in this week's episode.
We sure do. We've got fire, we've got rain, or maybe a lack of rain is a better way to put it. We've got dinosaur fossils for sale, and a fight over fossil fuels in the city of Longmont.
A $3 million deal between the city and two oil and gas companies is pushing surface wells out of the city limits, but does that actually change anything when it comes to drilling?
Longmont's still going to get fracked, and the climate is still going to get damaged the same amount from before.
We'll get a look below the ground at the city's new drilling ban.
Denver Comic-Con is coming up on the weekend of June 15.
Now, you've heard the saying, not all heroes wear capes, right?
I believe there's an entire movie about why that is a bad idea.
That's so true. I mean, they can get caught in things, they can get sucked into jet engines, or just, you know, stepped on, ripped.
It didn't take long. It was just a little bit of super glue, but it was cool to be able to just help them and send them on their way.
Hey, Spider-Man does not wear a cape, and he's still awesome.
Mm-hmm.
But for the heroes that do, there is a special kind of hero out there who fixes things when they go wrong. Plus, if you're a fan of Stanley Kubrick, you'll want to keep your eyes wide open for the new movie Filmworker.
I see what you did there.
Thank you very much. My eyes were wide open for that joke.
We'll hear what film critic Howie Mofsovitz has to say about it. But first, wildfire season is ramping up in the region. Fire teams are now working to quash one outside Durango, and Utah recently stopped another. That state is right now doing prescribed burns to reduce the chance of a bigger blaze. We've been following people involved in fighting wildfires, from scientists to cooks. One of those people is already on site at a wildfire now, Makoto Moore. The meteorologist is usually based out of Pueblo, Colorado, but over the weekend he got a call. They needed him to head south to a wildfire across the border in Ute Park, New Mexico.
I thought it was bad up in my neck of the woods, and down here they've received even less precipitation, less snowfall. So this entire area is dry.
So Moore is now working to set up portable weather stations. That's so that they can monitor how changes in wind and rain could affect the fire. He said he's heard of other incidents that are cropping up in the region, and it is just the start of what could shape up to be a busy season.
In a number of states like Montana, New Mexico, and California, they had primary elections this week.
So if you live in Colorado, go out, check your mailbox. You may have already gotten your ballot for the June 26th primary. I got mine.
I haven't, but I'm also really bad about checking my mail.
You should get on that.
I really should get better at that.
For the first time this year in Colorado, people who aren't affiliated with either major political party will still be able to participate. But there is a caveat. Unaffiliated voters can only return either the Democratic or the Republican ballot. If you try to send both of them back, neither will be counted.
Consider yourself warned at this point.
Yes.
So one of the big items to be decided in the primary, who will be the Democratic and Republican candidates to replace Governor John Hickenlooper, who is term limited. Late last week, the four Democratic candidates squared off in a debate hosted by Colorado Public Television. They discussed their plans for everything from transportation and education to how to fix the state's budget. KUNC State Capitol reporter Binta Berkland has more.
Lieutenant Governor Donna Lynn, former State Senator Mike Johnston, Congressman Jared Polis, and former State Treasurer Kerry Kennedy mostly agree on policies, but there are some differences, like health care. Polis backs a single-payer plan.
We're the only country in our state of Colorado in the industrialized world not to have universal health care. Let's get there.
While Lynn, who was at one time an executive for insurance provider Kaiser Permanente, supports universal health care, she's opposed to single-payer.
I'm not a supporter of the single-payer system because I don't think we can accomplish that in Colorado, and our voters rejected it in 2016.
On the education front, Kerry Kennedy and Mike Johnston have different views on a bill he sponsored to change how teachers are evaluated and base part of it on student growth.
The teachers feel demoralized by this. They know there's a lot more going on in their kids' lives than just what's happening in the classroom. Other states that have taken this approach have backed off, and they're absolutely within their right to make that your record.
Kennedy is referring to a TV ad attacking Johnston's bill. All the candidates signed a pledge to run positive campaigns. She said she wouldn't call for it to be removed because it's from the PAC, Teachers for Kennedy, and not from her own campaign.
There are differences in our approaches to education policy, and it's important that the teachers have the ability to express their opinion in a race that matters to them.
But Johnston fired back, saying Kennedy supported the teacher evaluation measure.
In 2012, you called it a national model that helps give us the tools to drive towards student achievement. So I don't know when you changed your mind on that. It's published under your name.
As he was talking, she quietly said she didn't remember that. The Teachers for Kennedy ad also attacked Polis for being pro-school voucher.
From what I can tell, the attack on me was based on an op-ed I wrote almost 20 years ago.
While in Congress, he says he's never backed vouchers.
And I have a 100% voting record. I have an A with the NEA. And it just seems to me it's a failure of leadership to stoop to that level and attack fellow Democrats.
Polis and Kennedy are considered the front runners, followed by Johnston and Lynn. All were asked how they would handle the next recession, which could happen in the next 4 years. Lynn said she'd increase the state's reserves to 10%, something she tried to do this year.
That's prudent. We didn't get that far, and clearly we have some pent-up demand for things like roads and education. So it was a little bit of a balance, but I would definitely say that next year we've got to take the tough step of adding to our rainy day fund that we have.
She's not the only one who wants to increase the rainy day fund. Kennedy does as well, saying the state must invest wisely.
And I took steps to move state investments, taxpayers' money, out of risky Wall Street investments so that here in Colorado, taxpayers didn't lose money in their state investments in the same way that other states lost hundreds of millions of taxpayer dollars.
Johnston would look to make changes to state laws to reduce spending.
Stop criminalizing mental health, stop criminalizing drug addiction, and stop criminalizing poverty. Those kind of reforms are some of the few big ideas in the state that would actually save the state hundreds of millions of dollars in the state budget, and that would be where I would start.
Polis also wants to reform sentencing laws and said if governor, he would focus on job growth, touting his own experience as an entrepreneur.
And empowering people to be able to support themselves and perhaps someday even create jobs for others is what an economic recovery and economic growth is all about. I'm the only one who's done it.
The Democratic primary for governor has been spirited and is expected to be close. An added uncertainty is the fact that for the first time, unaffiliated voters can participate in party primaries. I'm Benta Berkland at the state capitol.
The Republican candidates participated in a separate debate. We'll have coverage of both, which you can find at KUNC.org.
And keep an eye out for a special pre-primary election episode of the podcast that'll include details on both debates and much more.
The Longmont City Council recently entered into a $3 million deal to permanently stop surface drilling in city limits. The move has been widely hailed by the town's mayor as a victory over the growing oil and gas industry. But as KUNC's Matt Bloom explains, just because it's out of sight doesn't mean it isn't still happening.
Dale Rademacher is the first to admit that his office is a bit messy these days, but the general manager for the Longmont Public Works Department knows exactly what he's looking for.
I have a big map.
Oh, wow.
The problem is it's a little bit hand-drawn.
It's tucked behind a door in the corner and is of the city's east side. There's arrows and lines scribbled all over it in black marker, and its edges are starting to furl.
These are two of the sites that are identified in the future coming up.
He's talking about proposed drill sites just north of town. Right now, there are 8 active oil and gas wells within city limits. They're marked with little white circles and pink squares. But if all goes according to plan...
It's always been our goal, I believe, as a community and certainly as a staff and our direction from city council has consistently been, do everything you can to move drilling operations outside the city.
But that doesn't mean they'll just magically disappear overnight. It's going to happen in stages, with the closing of a few wells at a time before opening new ones, and all while leasing out mineral rights below ground.
I think about it all the time.
I met Josh James at a park near Union Reservoir in one of the city's active wells. He lives about a mile from here. While surface drilling is out, the agreement allows operators to horizontally drill underneath the city from wells just outside of town.
Longmont's still going to get fracked, and the climate is still going to get damaged the same amount from before.
James is a critic of oil and gas drilling and belongs to several grassroots groups trying to ban fracking altogether.
We feel like this is a point in time where communities have to start being defiant towards this industry and towards the laws that this industry has actually written for itself.
But Colorado cities don't have a lot of power in this arena. Longmont voters already tried and failed in 2016 to ban fracking. That's why Mayor Brian Bagley is confident this is the best option for his community.
We can't outlaw fracking. Fracking occurs approximately 8,000 feet underneath the surface. We can't control that. We can control the surface through creative means and mechanisms, and that's what we did.
Bagley's now encouraging other cities to find a compromise with oil and gas operators.
What really is different now than past agreements or past situations is that the oil and gas operators are now running up against populated cities. The Front Range, you know, this is fairly new to us.
Drilling applications with the state have risen about 70% in the past year. That's fueling new conflicts between residents and operators everywhere, from Boulder County to Greeley and Broomfield.
Yeah, let's be in the shade down there.
Longmont resident Judith Blackburn attended nearly every public meeting leading up to the deal. Sitting underneath a red umbrella on her patio, she says she's pleased with the outcome. But there's one thing that worries her.
It's really only a matter of time till well pipes, no matter how deep they are, and the cracking of shale in order to release the oil and gas, it's only a matter of time until all of those leak. I mean, we're kind of in a big experiment here.
We reached out to the companies involved in the deal, Cub Creek Energy and Top Operating Company, about their future plans, but didn't hear back by the deadline for our story. In a written statement, the Colorado Oil and Gas Association said it supports the agreement, but that Longmont is not a one-size-fits-all solution. Back at Dale Rademacher's office, he says he knows that the plan to wipe surface wells off the face of his map is divisive, but adds it's better than doing nothing at all.
On the other hand, I would surmise that almost everyone in the community would agree that reducing the number of locations and pushing them further away from both Union Reservoir and the urbanized area of the city is a good thing for Longmont.
One of the city's active wells is on schedule to be capped and plugged by September. After that, the timeline is more uncertain with the others. It's dependent on when operators break ground on new replacement wells on land outside Longmont city limits. For KUNC, I'm Matt Bloom in Longmont.
Now, I'm not a scientist, Aaron, but I'm going to go out on a limb and make a connection here. Fossil fuels probably come from fossils.
I think you're onto something.
I think I might be. We are rich in both in this area of the country. And a fossil from Wyoming was just auctioned off in Paris. The skeleton is almost 30 feet long and belonged at one point to a carnivorous dinosaur. KUNC's Ray Ellen Bichel reports.
David Pauly is president of the Society of Vertebrate Paleontology, and he gets why someone would want to own such a thing.
They're beautiful, exciting, wonderful things.
But Pauly says they're not art. They're part of the Earth's history, a part that's getting harder for scientists and museums to access as auctions like this one price them out of the market. Pauly says they've been increasing.
Yes, they seem to be, certainly over the last 30 years, they have become more common.
Countries like Mongolia and China have laws preventing fossils from leaving their borders. But in the U.S., it's finders keepers, as long as it's found on private property, not public land. The owner can then do what they want with it, even sell it off to the highest bidder at an auction under the Eiffel Tower, which is exactly what happened in this case. It sold for over $2 million.
The StoryCorps mobile booth wrapped up their stay in Fort Collins in May, and over the coming months, we will continue to bring you stories recorded at the booth. Today, we hear from Rachel DeCall and Andrew Milbauer. Now, both are high school teachers in Fort Collins.
Rachel, a Black woman, and Andrew, a gay man, came to the booth for a wide-ranging conversation about embracing their differences and how they negotiate their identities and careers in a majority white and straight environment.
I'm biracial. My mom's white. My dad is Black. I really haven't interacted with my dad since I was 12. Mostly it was my mom's family that I interacted with because my dad's family was not in Kansas. They were mostly in Georgia. I look at my skin, I see I'm Black, but I'm like, what the hell does that mean? Like, I feel like I had such a sheltered life. My mom did a great job sheltering me from a lot of the bullshit that probably completely Black families rather than blended families have.
How do you pick the clothes that you wear to work as a Black woman?
I think when I first started working in Fort Collins, which is a super white town from where I come from, which is Wichita, Kansas, I noticed that I stood out. And so I made a point to be the one who stood out for a reason. Like I, as you know, wear headbands every single day. And that's so that I can be recognized. And I mean, I know a lot of people wear headbands, but nobody's a big, tall Black woman who wear headbands and have poofy hair and stuff like that. So I make sure that I dress in a way that's not too black and not too flamboyant. What about you? How do you blend in or stand out or both or neither?
I'm kind of on a sliding gay scale depending on the audience. When I first started at the school, I was a little bit more straight acting, and yes, there's self-hatred involved with that, but I don't like being identified as a straight person, so after a few months, I kind of thought, screw it, and I probably act gayer at work than I really am just because I want to make sure that they don't think I'm straight.
Are you out to your students?
Yes, I am.
So, because I'm obviously out to my students, they all know that I'm black, so... I feel like I'm probably the only black teacher that a lot of these kids have ever had. When I start talking about my black experiences, it kind of goes quiet. Like, they don't know how to react to that.
You know, there are definitely times in my life where I'm glad I can drop my voice a little bit and tone down the camp and pass. But I hate the fact that no matter where I work, I have to ask my boss permission to be openly gay with my students.
Oh, yeah.
And so there's the trade-off is when you can pass, a lot of times straight people expect you to pass.
Mm-hmm. I make sure that I stand out, and that's how I fit in. With all of the racial violence and police violence that has been going on in our country for the last 10 years or so, it's extremely terrifying, not just for me, but for every black person I've ever known. I actually feel safer here in Fort Collins, where there aren't so many black people, because I am the black girl. Like, oh, you know that girl that wears the headbands? She's okay. She drives a Subaru Outback. She has two kids in elementary school. She has a house with a lawn. She's married. She's super boring. She's a teacher at a high school. Boring. So I try to make my life as boring and, shall we say, white as possible so as to stand out so that when, not if, when the time comes that I am singled out for my race, I might be better recognized because I'm in this town of white people and I can stand out as a black person. I blend in by standing out.
And for more from the StoryCorps mobile booth, just drop by KUNC.org. StoryCorps is sponsored locally by Kaiser Permanente.
Don't go anywhere. There's a lot more great stuff coming up, including an introduction to the unsung superhero of Denver Comic Con.
I can't wait to meet them. But first, let's talk about climate change. The effects of climate change are already being felt at the headwaters of the West's most important river system. That's according to a new study. Luke Runyon has more.
The Colorado River is the water source for some 40 million people in seven states. Warmer temperatures high up in the mountains, where the river gets its start, are already reducing its flow and melting snow earlier in the year.
If we have less of it stored, and if it's coming down early in the year, then we have a mismatch between when the precipitation falls and when we actually need it.
Stephen Saunders is director of the nonprofit Rocky Mountain Climate Organization, which compiled the report for local governments in northwest Colorado. While other parts of the West have recorded declines in mountain snowfall, the river's headwaters haven't. And if greenhouse gas emissions are reduced now, Saunders says temperature increases could happen slower, easing some of the effects.
Every year at Denver Comic Con, there are tons of caped crusaders and fantastical sci-fi characters running around the Colorado Convention Center. With all those amazing costumes, there's a lot that can go wrong and a lot of potential repairs to make.
Exactly. When Harry Potter's glasses break or a stormtrooper's helmet gets a crack in it.
Someone too enthusiastic with the lightsaber.
Who comes to their rescue? KUNC arts reporter Stacey Nick went to Comic-Con last year and met the hero to the superheroes.
For the uninitiated, cosplay, short for costume play, is when fans of comics, movies, and TV shows dress up as their favorite characters. The costumes can be incredibly detailed and cost hundreds of dollars to make. They can also break. That's where Alex Freeze comes in.
So I've got some sequins, just kind of white, generic iridescent sequins, because those are a pain when they fall off.
Yes, instead of dressing up as Wonder Woman or Harley Quinn, this weekend, Freeze dons a camouflage army jacket with her title, Cosplay Medic, emblazoned on the sleeve. In her Star Wars t-shirt, the 28-year-old sits at her dining room table going over her supplies.
I've got multicolored wire, I've got safety pins, glue dots, I'll have super glue. I have wig pins, bobby pins, a wig brush, baby wipes, clear nail polish, assorted colors of Sharpies, duct tape, Q-tips, cotton balls, pliers, and nail files.
So at this point, you might be asking yourself, what exactly is a cosplay medic?
A cosplay medic is somebody who carries around kits that have some sewing stuff and some glue and quick repair stuff for the cosplayers at the event who maybe don't have that stuff with them because it doesn't quite work with their costume, and are able to help them just maintain the look they want to throughout the con.
And while her cosplay outfits usually take weeks to finish, this idea came together at the last minute.
If I used to do costuming for theater, so it was really easy for me to kind of put it together, and then it turned out to be a lot of fun. And I got to talk to a lot of people because of it, so I decided to do it again this year.
Last year, Denver's fifth annual Comic-Con hosted almost 115,000 comic book and sci-fi fans, many of whom came dressed to thrill. But while the idea of cosplay is big, the idea of cosplay medics is just beginning. San Diego's Comic-Con International and Florida's SuperCon both have them, but last year at Denver's Con, most people didn't know quite what to make of Freeze.
A lot of people were asking because I have thread all down my backpack in different colors, and they were asking if it was usable, and I had tape and stuff hanging out, and they asked if they could use it, and I was like, yeah, that's what it's for.
Much of her time will be spent stitching up tears and gluing back together broken props. Her favorite fix last year? Helping out a character from the video game Fallout, who was late for the annual cosplay contest but broke his replica gun. An essential element to his look.
It didn't take long. It was just a little bit of super glue, but it was cool to be able to just help them and send them on their way.
When she's not busy helping out fellow cosplayers, Freeze works the night shift as an ambulance dispatcher in Aurora.
So, a medic.
Yep.
But like any good superhero, Freeze doesn't accept money for her cosplay services.
I just don't ask for anything. It's my gift to the con. I just like it. It's fun.
And Freeze has some advice for her fellow cosplayers, so they don't have to seek out her services this weekend.
Try not to leave it till the night before. I'm guilty of that. Because if you're frustrated, and it's better to walk away for a day. So, and when you leave everything till the night before, you can't walk away, and you just get frustrated, and stuff gets broken and ruined, and you won't be as happy with your finished product.
And if you do tear your cape or your wig gets tangled at Denver Comic-Con, keep an eye out for Alex Freeze. She may not be able to leap a tall building in a single bound, but she might just be able to save the day.
That was arts reporter Stacey Nick, who says Alex Freeze will be back in action at this year's Denver Comic-Con the weekend of June 15th. The new documentary, Film Worker, is about the legendary filmmaker Stanley Kubrick, but not quite. For KUNC film critic Howie Movshevitz, who teaches film and television at CU Denver, it's about the man who helped Kubrick be Kubrick.
Maybe the smartest thing in Tony Zierra's documentary Film Worker is that the movie never tries to explain. It shows plenty, but leaves the why to the audience. And the reason for that may be that for some things there is no explanation possible in the course of a film, if ever. The subject is a man little known outside just one part of the world of film. Leon Vitali's an English former actor. He was a young man in 1975 when Stanley Kubrick chose him for a major role in Barry Lyndon. Vitali had already become devoted to Kubrick's work, so getting this part was a happy event. But afterwards, Vitali quit acting to work with Kubrick in whatever way possible. For the next 25 years, Vitali was Kubrick's assistant. And to this day, Vitali works for the Kubrick estate, preparing restorations of the films and solving technical problems. He was far more than Kubrick's assistant, though, and Vitali chose for himself the inclusive word film worker. It's likely that no one on Earth knows more about Kubrick and about the films than Leon Vitali. Film Worker is a stunning film, but it takes a while to see its genius. Vitali looks like a strung-out old rocker from the 1960s. He's either in a ski cap or he wears a bandana covering his hair. Little wisps hang out like old strings. He's grizzled and gaunt. And for a time, if you don't already know about Vitali, you wonder why the film isn't just about Kubrick himself. After all, Kubrick's the celebrity. He's the great, fastidious, seductive, tyrannical maker of Dr. Strangelove, 2001 A Space Odyssey, A Clockwork Orange, and Full Metal Jacket. There are tons of stories, some fantasy, some accurate, about how the great master painter or filmmaker so-and-so really didn't do X, Y, or Z. It was really the ever-devoted, loyal retainer who wrote that great line of dialogue or directed that stunning sequence. But Film Worker is not about how Kubrick didn't do the brilliant work. The documentary doesn't claim that Leon Vitali really did all the great magical sequences in the Kubrick pictures. And neither does Vitali himself claim greatness. He's modest and matter-of-fact, but as actors and studio executives insist, Kubrick could not have done so many great things without Leon Vitali helping with virtually every aspect of the making of those films. Vitali chose actors for small but critical roles. He worked with actors on their performances. He directed the last parts of Eyes Wide Shut after Kubrick died. Vitali really does seem unlikely. Sitting back on a sofa, his head covered by that bandana, Vitali looks like he might have the energy to pick up a script. He's exhausted, like a guy drained by whatever it is he's been doing. And from what people say about him, he simply might be used up from his years working for Stanley Kubrick. Actor Ryan O'Neill, star of Barry Lyndon, says that Kubrick ran Vitali without mercy. He constantly had more jobs for him. Kubrick supposedly was a very harsh taskmaster, and not a whole lot of fun to work with. One wonder is what Leon Vitali got and gets out of his devotion to Stanley Kubrick and the films. Vitali says he loved Kubrick, but that word can mean all sorts of things. Vitali gave up acting, and he was well-trained and good at it so that he could work nearly anonymously, although for a legendary artist. So Vitali gave up fame and probably fortune also to be the guy supporting it all. His contribution seems enormous, but at a major Kubrick celebration a couple of years ago, Vitali was neither invited nor mentioned. He seems not to mind. Perhaps he doesn't need to be acknowledged. The movie Film Worker leaves it to the world to speculate on the meaning of devotion. For KUNC, I'm Howie Mofshevitz.
And one last thing before we get out of here. Governor John Hickenlooper and Denver Mayor Michael Hancock are on board with the idea of bringing a Winter Olympics to Colorado. Unfortunately, not everyone is as enthusiastic about the idea, as KUNC's Michael DeJoanna reports.
You can't get any more Colorado than winter sports. And an exploratory committee looking into a Colorado bid concluded that a Winter Games would be a good financial move for the state and one that can be done with private money. Businessman Rob Cohen led the committee, which took input from around the state and released their findings Friday in a 231-page report.
Our model is that there would be no taxpayer direct dollars used in the organizing committee or putting on the games.
Still, supporters of No Olympics Colorado, a group critical of the game's cost, remain skeptical.
I don't believe that there really is any risk management gimmick or any private insurance tool that can completely eliminate the risks to the taxpayers.
The next step is the likely formation of a bidding committee, but that could be 2 or 3 years away, leaving time for community discussions. Ultimately, though, voters may have the last word. The report also recommends a statewide vote around 2020 on whether to bring the games. That's one idea that gets praise from No Olympics, yet it won't stop them from pursuing a separate initiative in Denver this fall or next spring to require a vote if any physical or financial resources are used for any games. For KUNC, I'm Michael DeJoanna.
This has been KUNC's Colorado Edition. Our show this week was produced by me, Erin O'Toole.
And me, Ashley Jeffcoat. KUNC Managing Editor Brian Larson contributed to our show. Our intro music is Remember Me by Colorado musician Calatana.
Other music we heard in this episode was Soul Burned Away by Robert Abraham, Strange Dog Walk by Blue Dot Sessions, and Long Way Home by Spinning Ratio.
Our outro music is Good Grief by Ryan Little.
If you like what you're hearing, make sure you don't miss an episode. We will be back with more great stories for you to enjoy next week.
You can subscribe to Colorado Edition at KUNC.org or on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. And join us next Sunday evening at 9 on KUNC.